Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show on BBS Radio. It is October 30th, year 2010. I am a mystic and scientist and have studied creation physics and psychology for over 40 years and have produced a series of books, most importantly a book entitled The Heart Doctrine, which explains how in mystical and religious teachings the I experience in the human being is claimed to originate out of the heart. So in the sense, your deeper self or deepest self is associated with the heart. And that heart doctrine can be found in all different religious traditions, including Christianity, Kabbalah, yoga, Tibetan Buddhism, Blavatsky's secret doctrine, and elsewhere. So the heart doctrine explores the science of human consciousness, and I maintain that the last century of modern science has been completely off base in assuming that the material brain in the head produces consciousness. And I maintain that this is a completely false understanding. I call it the head dogma. I say instead that the I experience originates out of the heart, and consciousness in your body is related to the blood flow in your body. So even if you put your consciousness into your feet, it increases the blood flow to your feet, and you can feel your feet in your feet because your consciousness can be distributed all through your body, and it's related to the blood flow and the oxygenation of the body that occurs with the blood flow. So the heart doctrine explains this alternative view of this very deep mystery in modern science of the nature of human consciousness and whether human beings actually have some type of I, meaning the letter I, capital. Do we have some kind of I? Like people all the time say, I this, I that, I am Christopher, I am hungry, I am all these different things we say I to. What is I? Is there some kind of singular I within the human being? People talk as if there is, and yet scientists would completely deny this. And they maintain that our sense of self has to do with certain cerebral cortex activity. So they think it has to do with our learning up in our mind, in our brain. From a mystical perspective, that's another complete mistake. And human beings do have an I, which is not simply a collection of molecules or a collection of neurons, but actually this I is like a singularity point or center or zero point center. And there's actually a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. The heart is not simply a material organ, but the heart, there's a physical heart, but then there's a psychical heart, and then a spiritual heart center, and ultimately a divine source emanation. So in a sense, there's different levels to the self, and these are associated with the heart. And the mystical plight to know thyself has to do with the awakening and opening of the heart center. And within this heart center, mystics describe a jiva atma, or a monad, or a divine spark. And this element is inherently self-illuminating like the sun. Okay, the heart is regarded as the sun of the body, and there's a self-illuminating element, and that element is both the life principle within the material body, and somehow in science they cannot explain how the heart's pulse is generated out of the heart, the SA node and the AN node. The heart has its own inherent pacemaker. And I'm saying that the electrical impulse of life produced in the heart is actually a consequence of a higher dimensional metaphysical forces that act to bring life into the heart. And that self within the heart is also the source of consciousness, and consciousness is like light, or it is light. If we awaken, we experience being illuminated. You experience an increase in the inner light that one experiences. Mystical Christians talked about the practice of light gaining, that we want to learn to live in the light. But people, as they are, they live in outer darkness, and they lack this light of consciousness. So the true health, the true consciousness in the human being is associated with the heart. But what happens through life to people is that they form a second self as a product of their conditioning and environment and education and their life experiences. And this second self is that which is acquired from outside, because it is shaped by outside influences and how the individual adapts to cope with their life circumstances. So we acquire or develop a personality. A persona, it comes from the Greek. In Greek theater, actors would have a mask on a stick and they would put it up in front of their face. And according to whose role, who they were acting, they would have different masks. Well, we have a mask like that, our persona or a personality. So as a human being develops, a persona or personality can become more and more dominant, and the true self experience connected to the heart can pass into the subconscious. Gurdjieff describes human beings as forming a false consciousness system, and he describes their true consciousness passing into what he calls their subconscious. So we explore on this program then the mysteries of human consciousness and this idea of the heart doctrine and ideas about the higher dimensional physics to the heart, like what actually does this entail. We also have been exploring studies of Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, a classic book of Western occultism published in 1888, described by Manly Hall as undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. And this grand book is not taught within our universities or educational system. But it's a remarkable book, and Blavatsky, over 100 years ago, described creation according to the stanzas of Zan. And the stanzas of Zan, she says, are these archaic poetic verses that she says were dictated by divine beings to the sons of light at the beginning of the fifth cycle of humanity on this planet. So Blavatsky claims these stanzas of Zan have this ancient history with the origin of humanity in this round, and that they were dictated by these divine beings. So she is saying they are revealed teaching. Okay, see, some knowledge is derived from the senses, but the other possibility is that some learning and knowledge is revealed. And these stanzas of Zan depict the creation of the universe. And my work on the Secret Doctrine, it carries out a comparative analysis of modern physics and cosmology to Blavatsky's teaching in the Secret Doctrine. And what we find is remarkable coincidences or confirmations of the things that Blavatsky was claiming in 1888. Blavatsky was claiming the universe emerged out of what? An apparent nothingness, which is not a nothingness, but which is the void, or the plenum, sorry. And similarly, in modern physics, we have the idea that space is not empty, it is the plenum, that there's an infinite amount of energy and potential latent within space itself. And Blavatsky predicted seven-dimensional hyperspace, which he called the seven-skinned eternal parent space. And all the newest theories in M theory and string theory postulate seven higher hidden or compacted dimensions, exactly in the manner as described by Blavatsky. So there are remarkable correspondences between Blavatsky's teaching and modern science. And then lastly, we discussed through the program the teachings of G.I. Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff developed the fourth way teaching, and his major student was P.D. Uspensky. And Uspensky's book about Gurdjieff, entitled In Search of the Miraculous, recounts Uspensky meeting Gurdjieff in 1915 in Russia, and he gives an account of Gurdjieff's teachings and lectures. So there's the Uspenskian version of the Gurdjieff teaching, and then we have Gurdjieff's own book, and it's one of the most unusual books in the sacred literature of the world, and it's called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And in that book, Gurdjieff presents his teachings in a very different language and form. Now, over the past months, we've been talking about the physics of the secret doctrine and about the heart doctrine. And then more recently, Jim and I have started talking about the Gurdjieff work once again. And we're going to kind of pick up on all these themes today and I'll pause and welcome Jim. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, good. I meant to ask, did you receive a copy of The Slugs?
Yes, I did. Thank you very much. Yeah, it came the other day.
Yeah, it's pretty nice, eh?
Yeah.
It forms such a nice companion volume to Psychological Illusions in the same format and such.
Yeah, it's nice that, as you say, that they're in the same format, and again, it's I like the way it's laid out. Zelchka's done a very, very good job. Again, like it's really attractive, nice looking book, and I should say that, you know, I haven't read this current edition, but I think it's pretty similar to what you had before. And the odd thing about Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson is how little commentary exists on it. There's very little, actually, and I think your book is really, really good. I think the content of your commentary is very, very informed and insightful, and I think you have such a deep appreciation of the other aspects of Gurdjieff's teaching, which provide you with insight into what he's getting at in a much more indirect fashion in Beelzebub's Tales. It's not easy to understand Beelzebub's Tales. You have to really work to mine the gold that's there. But I think your book is The Slugs is. I was really impressed, even when you were first working on it, that you were able to articulate that, because I say there's so little out there versus the earlier versions of Gurdjieff's teaching, derived largely from In Search of the Miraculous and from Views from the Real World, which were a collection of his lectures in the early 1920s. There's all sorts of material that's been derived from that and comments on that exposition of the teaching. But Beelzebub's Tales is a very, very different animal. It's a completely different statement of the teaching in some sense, at least in a superficial sense. It's completely different. But if you know the first part of it, the earlier part of it, as put forth in books like In Search of the Miraculous and Views from the Real World, then you can discern what he's getting at in such an indirect fashion in Beelzebub's Tales. And as I say, because you have a more comprehensive perspective, I liked The Slugs a lot. I think it's a very interesting work, and anybody interested in Beelzebub's tales would certainly find it very interesting and informative. Beelzebub's tales is such a, I'm not even sure what it is in terms of it's so incomparable to anything else that I know of in modern literature, or as we were saying, I think on the last program, it takes the form of a speculative fiction, science fiction book, but it has all the elements of an epic tale. But it's sacred literature. It disguised sacred literature, but it's so different from what we normally would associate with sacred literature. So it's, as I say, it's really a unique work, and the depth of the book is such that it really requires a great deal of work to understand what this guy is saying. As even A.R. Oraj, who was a pupil of Gurdjieff's and described by many prominent writers of the 20th century as the greatest living editor in the English language, worked on the translation and over and over with Gurdjieff of the book into English, and said himself that he didn't really understand it. You know, he felt he understood parts of it, but he didn't feel he had really grasped the key to deciphering the meaning of the book, which, in a way, I mean, you can take that two ways. In a way, you could say, well, can't be that good a book, or it's a very deep and profound book, and I would lean more to the latter interpretation. While at the same time admitting that I don't really understand it myself. I mean, I just haven't studied it closely enough. It requires study. So that's
yeah. Well,
very well,
this is a book that really orients you to reading Beelzebub's tales.
Yes,
like
it is.
Read The Slugs, like you're not going to be completely lost like one otherwise is tales. Because the tales are just like, all over, everywhere. And the Gurdjieff describes such peculiar incidences and scenes, like it's bizarre, really.
His style is difficult too, is purposely difficult, because if you read his other books, specifically if you read Meetings with Remarkable Men, which is very clearly written and is a wonderful book, and it's clear that he could have written the book in a straightforward style, but he has this very, very peculiar cadence to his writing and use of ellipses and all sorts of parenthetical observations in the body of a sentence that makes you really have to work and concentrate to read it. But it's especially so, I think, in the first 50 pages. I think after a while, the book gets easier to read. Maybe you get more used to his style, but I think it's actually more purposely difficult in the first 50 pages. So you have to sort of persevere through your feelings, like, why am I reading this? This is completely insane. But at the same time, you realize that, but it's not. I mean, it's, you know, there's method in this madness somehow. So, if you want to read Beelzebub's tales, you should certainly can just read it. But if you want to read it and understand it, this book would certainly provide an orientation, and it provides a very interesting overview of the main themes of the work and certain things that recur that are of vital importance to understanding his purpose in writing the book.
Yeah, it's funny. Yesterday I decided I'm going to read the book again, and last night I read the 50-page foreword that he has and grasped it much more.
Oh, yeah.
In a way, it's bombastic, and one doesn't like it in a way. He even says that. He compares it to a trans-Caucasian Kurd who buys a hot pepper thinking it's a fruit, and he spends all his money on it. And then because he spends all his money on it, he has to eat it, even though it's so hot, it's burning away, and he can't stand it. And Gurdjieff kind of compares that to people reacting to his own book. You kind of bought this kind of hot pepper and you don't know what you're getting, and then you bite into it, and yeah. So it's a very as you say, the foreword is meant to put people off. And I mean, it's a remarkable book. I find, I mean, I've just produced this interpretive book on it. And when I start reading it again, like to me now, when I read it, it reads so beautifully, and it's so easy to read. Whereas when I began, like it was like very cumbersome, and I couldn't maintain that breadth of attention in myself to read it. It actually develops something in you to understand and grasp it. And Gurdjieff himself says that's part of the intention of why it's written in the form that it is. But
yeah,
anyway, I hope...
I was just going to say that very much conforms with what he means by... He makes a distinction repeatedly in his teaching between objective and subjective art. And objective art is art which is conscious in its origins and which has a specific purpose and is aimed at creating specific feelings and evoking the specific ideas in people who are properly prepared to understand the art. And that's clearly part of what he was trying to do in the way he wrote it, was he was trying to derange your senses, and it's kind of like the surrealists and the datists, but there's a further step because he's trying to bring them together in a different order, and he's trying to make you think and feel and react in a very non-habitual way. He derisively refers repeatedly to the bon ton literary language, which is all the rage amongst writers of popular books. He's it's very humorous in his commentary upon writers and what is regarded as modern literature, and so there's that aspect to it too, that he definitely is trying to create this state in you that where you, and he's trying to evoke engage your attention and elevate your attention in a sense. And as you say, like when you read the book repeatedly, you gain something. There's something changes in you and your capacity to process it.
Yeah, it certainly does. It's, you know, this edition of The Slugs has something to me which a very, very significant addition to it, that it's got a new chapter based on Gurdjieff's analysis of the causes of war. And the new sections deal with the husnamus, what he calls the husnamus, which is a derogatory kind of term, a certain class of human beings. Like to say someone is a husnamus is like husnamus, you know, they have this urge to destroy other breathing creatures and to avoid being, they're always trying to pretend to be something that they are not, and they have all these negative impulses and characteristics. And this time in writing this book, there's a lot more of a presentation on the causes of war, the role of psychopaths and husnamus in the history of humankind in terms of their creating wars and the stock jugglers and how they present false teachings to undermine people's kind of understanding of divinity and such. So husnamus sciences and the whole section on the crats, what he calls the crats. And the book begins on a very unusual quotation. Because, see, when I wrote The Slugs over 5 years ago, I wasn't aware at that time of what was going on in the world. Like, I didn't know then even about 9/11 being a fraud. You know, I was still naive and had trust in the government and media and such, so I'd been completely deceived. And then I kind of woke up to that. And then now when I read his book on the causes of war, there's such subtle things with amazing applications to the situation in the world today with these, what Gurdjieff would call the power-possessing beings, because many of the husnamuses become power-possessing beings. And he talks about all the crats, like Democrats and aristocrats, and the plutocrats, and these are different kind of husnamus power-possessing beings. And he has such a funny analysis of them and their education and why humankind can't stop war. Because that I seem this time in reading Beelzebub's tales, I realized ever more deeply than I had before how it's a treatise on the causes of war and why humankind can't stop war and what that would take for that to happen. So, So this book, this version, you'll see once you get into it and read the new chapters, you'll see what a different emphasis and impact it has in this new book. You must have seen the pictures of the Georgia Guidestones, eh?
Of the what,
Did
sir?
You see that, Jim?
Of the what?
The Georgia Guidestones.
What is that?
Oh, the Georgia Guidestones are these stones, like monolith stones, like they weigh a couple tons or something, that are put up in Georgia in the States. And they're written in eight languages, and they have these kind of 10 principles for what they it says, age of reason. They're put up, their actual stone monuments have been put up by what Gurdjieff would call a husnamus. They're put up, the top principle engraved on these massive stones is, quote, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature. That's the first objective engraved into these huge, massive stones. And they're in Georgia, in the state of Georgia, in the United States. But anyway, that all ties in to the book. The book now opens on this very peculiar quotation, which reads, Husnamussian science, invented by certain pimpled beings among them, in which it is nonchalantly proved that the periodic reciprocal destruction on the earth is very, very necessary, and that if it did not exist, an intolerable overpopulation would result on the earth, and such economic horrors would ensure that men beings would begin to eat one another. So he has this whole thing about these Husnamussian signs about population reduction, and this was in Beelzebub's tales, and he has section talking about like these special societies of these power brain, these power possessing beings. It's so funny. His whole chapter, it's almost 100 pages at the end of the book. It's Beelzebub's opinions of war.
Yeah.
So when I reread that this time, there's a lot of new material, and it's added, I think, a new dimension to the book. So I'm very pleased with that. And I'm going to reread the tales myself, because I'd like for us over the next 2 to 3 shows to go through the tales and have reading from it and kind of do a series on Beelzebub's tales. But I need a bit more time to read through it again myself.
Yeah, I need time to go back and read it again too. Such an interesting book. So many,
So anyway, I thought today, Jim. I thought, why don't we open the phone lines up and we'll just carry on with our discussion. But any callers can call in today. We haven't opened them up more, and it's always interesting when we do and we get calls. So I'll just give the number out for BBS. Toll-free is 888-815-9756. And we'll just keep the lines open through the end of the day. We don't have any guests on. We had talked about maybe going through, having a look at Donna Brown's review of the Heart Doctrine book. So we could do that today, but then I also wanted to go into, we started talking last week about Gurdjieff and his influence on us and our early learning. So I wanted to go through some sections of psychological illusions. I thought maybe go through the definitions of psychology that are there particularly. How's that sound, Jim?
Yeah, sure, that's fine. All of the above.
Did you have a copy of Donna's review?
Yeah, I actually was just looking for it because I didn't realize it. Yeah, I've got it right here, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were going to do it last week, and we never did.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's worthwhile going through, and we can just discuss a few points as you go through it, like to elaborate.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because this is from Donna Brown in the Esoteric Quarterly, which is an online journal. I think it's just www.esotericquarterly.com. You can go online, or you could just use a search engine, put in Esoteric Quarterly, and it'll come up, and you can read it online. And it's a very good journal. It's very good, high quality, scholarly articles on esoteric matters. Donna reviewed God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine in an earlier edition, and she provided a very, very insightful and really concise and well-informed review of Christopher's book, and has done the same thing with the Heart Doctrine in the most recent issue of the Esoteric Quarterly. Very, very odd to find somebody who sort of gets your work so well, Chris. I'm always kind of astounded when somebody actually understands it now.
yeah, she's really well studied and really scholarly. But there's a lot of people in a way. Yeah. Yeah, it was nice to see, for sure. She really got, I thought, at the essence of like the arguments and the book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that there is a lot of people in a way. Like, I mean, you know, there are, and there are certainly people out there who are open-minded and everything. But I mean, in terms of people who specifically have an interest in consciousness, it's odd how so many of them sort of subscribe to the conventional ideas, which are adhered to with a very peculiar and really untenable. conviction, because the odd thing is about consciousness is that everybody begins by declaring routinely that we really don't understand it, we can't define it, we don't know how it arises, we don't know, you know, what it really is, and we don't know what happens to it when we die. But people always put a picture of a brain on the cover of their book or to start their article, and people seem to subscribe to the most simplistic ideas about consciousness, that basically there are two states of human consciousness: you're asleep and you're awake. And the Scientific American article, like there's a continuum from being in a coma to being alert, and that's basically it. And it's odd how over and over again in articles about consciousness, with some very notable and very significant exceptions, how many people subscribe to these ideas, with a conviction that it isn't based on anything. It's all based on assumptions, and I think most people would be shocked if you talked to them about consciousness and said to them that really within the scientific literature there's all sorts of material on consciousness, but nothing about really has ever linked consciousness to the human brain. That's all a supposition. It's all part of the working assumptive framework. And obviously you need a brain to have consciousness, but you also need a heart, and you need a circulatory system, and you need a body. And so I mean, it's so odd. Once you're challenged by the ideas that are articulated in the Heart Doctrine, to understand consciousness as something that doesn't necessarily originate in the brain, but rather the brain is reflecting as something more primary, then it changes your perspective on everything. You see through the fact that what is taken for granted, it may not necessarily be so. I mean, I'm quite willing to admit that, oh, yeah, it may be that the brain produces consciousness, but it is certainly not established as a scientific fact. And, in fact, the more people try to establish it, the more elusive that project becomes, and the more mysterious it becomes, and the more confounding it becomes. It's very much, I was thinking earlier today, it's very much like memory in psychological and scientific research. I mean, there's been a billion studies done on memory and aspects of memory, and psychologists are very good at describing certain aspects of memory, but nobody really understands it, like, and in its essence, like, what is memory? How does it relate to human consciousness? How is it related to the mind? Where is it stored? You know, these basic questions still elude us about memory, and it's the same thing with consciousness. These are massive mysteries within the current conventional psychological and scientific theorizing and experimentation.
I think one thing that's so interesting, though, is that what's unique about the mystical perspective is that your approach to the study of consciousness is through self-study. And what most convinces me that my consciousness is not centered up in my head and produced by the mind or brain in the head is my inner self-awareness. Because if I bring my attention to being aware of myself, my immediate experience is that my awareness can be throughout my body. Like I can put my attention into my feet and bring my awareness into my feet, and I can feel them getting warm. And is all that occurring in the mind, or is actually occurring in the feet, like, which is how I experience it?
No, but you could certainly argue that your brain is directing all that, and in a sense it is directing that, but that still doesn't mean that your consciousness is in your brain, or that your consciousness is being produced by your brain. Like, I mean, you could say that. Like, I mean, okay, if you want to increase blood flow to your feet, like, part of that, doing that is you can try to descend your feet. That will do it to a certain extent. But it also, like, I find, like, if I think the thought that I want to direct blood flow to my feet, that increases it too. So in a sense, like, you can do that with your mind and the brain to a certain extent. So I think most people would say that that's you're still your brain directing everything, but I would say no, it's your consciousness is something quite separate from that. Like, I mean, your awareness of your consciousness can be increased, and that's what I mean when you started to say about self-study. I think that's I agree wholeheartedly with you about that, because that's what the mystical teaching, that's how it's mystical teachings are so diametrically opposed to modern science, which wants to study everything externally in others, and it thinks that that's how you get objective understanding of everything psychological. But what the mystical teachings do through emphasizing self-study is to reveal that you can have a much, much greater awareness of your consciousness and of yourself by studying yourself and by trying to become more conscious. And those are processes that occur within yourself, and in a way they're quintessentially subjective because they're occurring to you. But there's an objective quality to the process because it adheres to certain dynamics and it reveals itself through the process of self-study. You begin to understand that other people have had the same experiences and that there is something objective in the way that this occurs. And that's kind of what convinces me that consciousness is something other than, as Uspensky argues, it's something other than the psychological functions. There's something quite apart from our psychological functioning, which is consciousness. Like Uspensky says, it's the background against which the psychological functions occur, and you can liken it to light. So certain psychological functions occur in the darkness, and there's very little illumination, but you can increase the illumination by attempting to become more aware of yourself. And that's kind of the great enigma, is that you can actually make yourself more aware of yourself, and you can, through observing yourself, you can see in yourself that there are times when you are more or less aware of yourself, and that you can function psychologically quite competently with very little awareness of yourself. So that kind of changes the whole dimension of things when you realize that there's this variability to consciousness itself. Like the light metaphor is really important because it's based on it's a metaphor, but it's also it's a psychological fact. There's such a depth to that metaphor, so it's very important to kind of, I think, to employ it and on its most basic level, this idea of things occurring in the darkness versus the greater level of illumination, I think really kind of captures something about what it is to study yourself in terms of a mystical or an esoteric teaching. Whereas in science and psychology, that is not a variable. It's ruled out by a priori because we're studying others, you know, we're studying rats or we're studying undergraduates or we're studying, you know, we're always studying consciousness in others. We're studying people who have brain operations, you know, and we're looking for consciousness in the brain and in a large part of the psychological and scientific literature on consciousness, it's almost as if people were just brains. It's like there's almost no recognition that they're actually very complex organisms that you know have bodies and have all these different systems within the body such as the brain and in the heart and in the solar plexus and the brain and in the spinal column and a circulatory system which the blood carries all sorts of information and all sorts of nutrients throughout the whole body. It's like this amazingly complex system is all sort of just eliminated within the psychological and scientific study of consciousness. It's like it doesn't exist.
Yeah, so there's only just the brain and the head.
Yeah, this little lump in a box somewhere, you know, which is divorced from the body is bizarre.
When I was saying about self-study, like, I think when a person starts to try to become more conscious of consciousness within themselves, then the more you do that, you begin to realize, oh, no, my consciousness isn't simply up in my head, because sometimes it feels like your consciousness is in your stomach when you've eaten too much. And in a way, that's how you experience yourself. So what I think is that self-study helps you realize, no, this is ridiculous, the idea that consciousness is only up in my head, because that's not, you know, that's just not how we experience ourselves. It's completely inconsistent with phenomenological facts. And another example of this is the pointing game. When I give lectures and I get people to point to the ceiling and point to a wall and point to their left foot and point to their right ear, and then I ask people to point to themselves. And almost 80 to 90% of the people point in the region of the heart or maybe more towards the throat. But hardly ever does anyone point to their head to indicate self. So now what that shows, in my view, is that kind of intuitive feeling that the center of ourself is connected to the heart. So that's kind of like, why don't people point to the head? If consciousness is just up in the head, why don't we point there? And then I see that partly what's happened in Western science is that the scientists have been confused by their own approach because they use the mind to try to understand consciousness. And using the mind centers the consciousness more in the head. And then they think that the minding is consciousness. See, that's what Western psychologists did. They confused all the different kind of cognitive and mental faculties. They confused that with consciousness. Whereas Gurdjieff said, no, consciousness is something separate than thinking and feeling and sensation. You know, it's separate from the psychic function. Whereas psychologists confuse consciousness with thinking and minding. And so that's how I think they made this mistake of the head doctrine, thinking that consciousness is produced by the brain in the head. So I think the other view about like consciousness and the body, I think that makes sense to people when you explain it, and then they even have experiences of what you mean by it. Like, I think it becomes clearer and clearer through self-study that, of course, my consciousness isn't simply up in my head.
Yeah,
nonsensical.
Anybody who who participates in any kind of physical activity on a regular basis and practices a discipline, whether it's working with your hands or doing a martial art or dancing or playing a sport, training for a sport, realizes, or doing yoga, realizes that, you know, your consciousness of your body can be greatly heightened through these activities and these practices. It's like Western science that has subscribed to this idea. As you say, it's like it's a self element in the study of consciousness. Is start thinking about consciousness and think, well, where's consciousness? And they end up thinking that it's in the head. It's like Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." I mean, people quote that all the time, but he's wrong, because, you know, your I am is not the result of thinking. You can be very aware of yourself without thinking, and in fact, within the mystical and esoteric tradition, that's one of the hurdles you want to try to get over. That's one of the main obstacles to the development of consciousness, is that constant ongoing thinking, in the Eastern phrase, the monkeys of the mind, or the turning of the mind, is one of the most formidable obstacles to realizing consciousness within yourself, because we're always thinking. But when we think, it's not something that we do, it's something that happens mechanically and automatically, and all you have to do to prove that to yourself is to try to stop thinking. Like when people meditate, what you find is that thinking intrudes, and thinking intrudes without you even knowing that it's going on. And then you have to remember your purpose, which is to try to stop thinking. So it's ludicrous to suggest that I think, therefore I am. No, that's wrong. And yet Western science still subscribes to that idea. It's like it's a fundamental tenet of Western science.
Yeah. It's fundamentally wrong. Like, in a way, I am. Like, I have to be before I can think. Like, the I am has to precede the thinking. And it puts the primacy on the mind in the head. And then Descartes is the one who thought that the place the soul connected to the body was the pineal gland.
Yeah.
Because it was one organ kind of in the center of the brain. And I think that's, I see like the pineal gland as being the heart of the brain. That term someone used in commenting on my article in the Esoteric Journal, he said, "Why don't you mention that the pineal is referred to as the heart of the brain?" I didn't know that.
Oh, okay, yeah, makes sense.
I would say in mystical teachings that the real I, the connection of the heart, the soul to the body, is through the heart, but the pineal gland is associated with the seventh chakra.
Yeah.
So it is light sensitive, because I would say that the light of the self within the heart is the light that can illuminate the pineal gland. That the pineal gland isn't only sensitive to external light, but also to the light of the self. So the pineal gland I would still see as a having mystical significance in terms of developing higher faculties of the heart. Because I'm not only saying that human consciousness is only in the heart. Of course, I'm not saying that. I mean, there's a whole system of seven chakras, and consciousness can pervade this whole system of the chakras and the physical body and the blood. So it's more complex. It's not only the material blood either.
It's just that you're saying that consciousness doesn't originate from the neurochemical processes in the head brain, which is what Western modern science says.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that consciousness actually is stepped down and originates in a human being from higher dimensions within the human being and within the cosmos, that light of consciousness is stepped down and manifests through the spiritual spark in the heart and is distributed throughout the body and illuminates the psychic functions in the head brain.
Yeah, and that's why you see you do different cognitive tasks and you can see how the blood flows to the part of the brain involved in a different cognitive task. So the neural activity is the object of consciousness, but
right.
The blood flow is related to the consciousness. It's like the pure I versus, like in William James, he distinguishes between the I and the it. Like our own thoughts and feelings are are objects of our consciousness. So those form on the it side. Okay, like our own thoughts and feelings. I mean, when one begins to observe oneself in the fourth way teaching, you begin to, you make that inner split between the I and the it.
It, yeah.
Becoming more conscious of your own thoughts and feelings and sensations. So you create that inner separation. It's said in the work that first you are one, meaning that a person is just fused with your own thoughts and feelings, and you're always embedded in them, always attached to them. You're fused with them. And then you begin to create inner separation by beginning to observe your own thoughts and feelings as objects of your consciousness. So that creates this inner separation between I and it. And then they say ultimately in the work, we are fused again and we become one again. But in the interim state, we kind of, the I and consciousness is something separate from the thoughts and the feelings and the sensations. It's what allows us to be aware of them. It's like light, and it's also like a background in which things can reveal themselves. So it's a very, the study of consciousness is so subtle and complex, Ajim. Like it's very different. It's taken many years to try to develop a language to be able to talk about it.
Well, that's what I think, you know, getting back to what we were talking about a little earlier about being introduced to Gurdjieff in the fourth way. What's particularly valuable, I think, in the fourth way teaching is that Gurdjieff, if this is an ancient teaching which Gurdjieff said had appeared and reappeared throughout history, and he had put it into a form to appeal more to the modern mind. And I had read some material from various, I was into a little bit into Zen Buddhism and some esoteric and mystical material before I came across Gurdjieff, but I'd never read anything which described the psychology of consciousness in such lucid and coherent terms and made it a practical guide for me so that I could follow this and employ these ideas and apply them to myself and to the study of myself and the study of others in the world. And one of the ideas that I think, and I think you were, this is what you were getting at earlier when you were talking about, in part, about self-study, and about the value, how you realize that your consciousness isn't in your head. One of the ideas that's so important in Gurdjieff is that he challenges this idea that we have one brain, that it's in our head, and that's the center of our intelligence is in our head. And he says, no, there's an intellectual center which deals with thinking and reasoning and abstract ideas and calculations, and that's centered in the head. But then there's an emotional brain, which is centered in the nerve plexus in the abdomen, in particular in the solar plexus, and that deals with emotions and feelings and with appetite of dimensions and deals with issues of all emotional psychological processes are centered in that center. And then there's a moving instinctual, well, two centers, but basically one, which is aligned in the spinal cord and in the organs of the body, and that's your physical intelligence, and is closely linked with your sexual center, which is centered in your sexual organs, and that's basically your organic bodily intelligence. So that you can think of people as human beings in their normal state as being three brain beings who have an intellectual, an emotional, and a physical center. So and function by thinking, acting, and feeling. And that idea of the centers, like that, each of these is a brain within us, and that they have their own speed of operation and their own kind of memory and their own kind of processes for processing information, is really like a radically different idea from anything in Western science. And when you begin to Gurdjieff describes in detail the functioning of the centers, and it says you have to learn to identify the different centers within you and how they work and how they don't work correctly. And he has all these wrong work of centers which he identifies that you're supposed to observe in yourself. That idea provides a framework for studying consciousness, how it manifests within yourself. And what you realize is exactly what you were talking about later, is like your consciousness isn't in your brain. When you're thinking, you're centered. You can be centered in your consciousness in the sense that you can be using one center more actively than the other. So when we're sitting here talking on the radio, we're thinking and we're speaking and we're trying to remember things and we're trying to formulate things. We're centered in our heads. But if we're doing a physical activity, if we're out, you know, raking the leaves in the backyard and working on the grounds, or if we're running, or if we're doing something physical, we're not centered in our head so much. We're more centered in our bodies. And if we're emotionally, if we're involved in something that arouses our passions or strong feelings for us, we're more centered in our emotional center. And each of this, within our day, this alteration between the centers goes on all the time, like where we're more focused in one center than the other. But all of these things can happen with what I spoke of earlier. They can occur with varying degrees of consciousness. You can be more or less conscious. Often we do things physically. I think almost anybody who's ever driven a car has had the experience where they've been driving along and they realize that for several minutes they've just been on automatic pilot, that they have not been aware of themselves being here driving this car. Sort of like you're just driving the car with almost minimal awareness. Or we walk along somewhere and that'll happen to us. And that kind of automaticity happens all the time to us in all of our centers. We have automatic emotional reactions, we have automatic thoughts, and we have automatic physical processes.
Yeah, that's just what I was going to say. That's how Gurdjieff sees us, our whole psychology. It's like on autopilot. Like in a way, there's nobody home.
Yeah.
There's no real I there. It's, you know, your mind is turning, your emotions are turning, and you're just caught up in it all, and this happens, and it engages your attention, and that reminds you of something else, and that engages your attention, and then you remember that nice blonde, and you start thinking of that, and then and you're like a dog that follows every scent, and, you know, all over the place. That's how Gurdjieff presents the normal psychopathology of human beings, that they're like automatons controlled by the automatic function, especially the automatic associative thinking that goes on. Yeah,
when he says that our lives, the majority of our lives, that we are in a waking sleep, that's what he means. We're sort of hypnotically associating to everything, and this is all occurring to us quite automatically and mechanically and involuntarily. It's not something that we do. This just happens to us, and we are not even aware that it happens to us. And that's the great discovery when you begin to study yourself in terms of the fourth way, is that to say that we're in a state of waking sleep, most people would say, well, no, when I'm awake, I'm awake. What are you talking about? Or even if people are sort of receptive to the idea, you have no idea how asleep you are until you really begin to study how asleep you are, and then you realize everything happens. I mean, that's one of Gurdjieff's really provocative statements in italics. Everything happens, and you realize, yes, everything does happen, because there is nobody home most of the time. Our sense of I is so undeveloped and incoherent, and one minute we're this one eye, and the next minute we're a completely different eye with a completely different set of interests and aims. And within us there are all these different eyes. As you know, he says, like in the Bible, man's name is legion. You know, we have some eyes that are stronger than others, but really we have no one eye. We have no one central coherent eye within ourselves. And what he asked,
real eye.
When he asked his pupils, Uspensky reports that meeting that they had in when Gurdjieff was teaching in Russia, and he asked people what they were aiming for. One person said, "I would like to be master of myself." And Gurdjieff said, "This is a properly formulated aim. Right now, you are not master of yourself, but you could be if you were to develop your consciousness and if you were to be able to to destroy all of these habits of thinking, feeling, and acting within yourself, you could acquire self-mastery. And he said this is a real aim for people to pursue. But it's so far from where we are, and our biggest obstacle is that we already believe that we have what we're supposed to work for. We believe that we have a unified I in the sense of a coherent I, and we believe that we do, and that nothing happens to us, that we're masters of our own fate. But you know, we're not, and that's I would submit to is that what goes completely unrecognized in modern psychological and scientific theorizing about consciousness is that we live in a state of waking sleep, and that our normal waking consciousness is not a single, undifferentiated, unified state, but it consists of all of these transitions, and that most of our waking experience consists of waking sleep. And nobody in psychology even comes close to thinking about this. We talk about the unconscious,
yeah.
But in a way, the unconscious is a misnomer, because all of our consciousness is an unconsciousness,
and
all of our normal waking consciousness is really should be better understood as an unconsciousness. And
I think it's really useful how Gurdjieff explains it in Beelzebub's Tales when he says, like, what formed is this false consciousness system, and how the essential consciousness passes into what we would call the subconscious.
Subconscious, yeah.
Yeah, that really, I think, is a helpful formulation.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a very different formulation from what he gave earlier when he was addressing his pupils in Russia and later in France. But it's so bizarre. I was actually writing to somebody earlier today, Chris, and I was talking about my book, But I'll Know My Song Well, which is about the first 5 years that we began to study the Fourth Way and to be introduced to esoteric teachings. And I said that, you know, I've written this really huge book, and it's an exposition of the Fourth Way, and it's a discussion of the implications of Gurdjieff's teaching for the study of consciousness. But it's autobiographical too, and it's about you and I and our discovery of this teaching and what it was like. And I said to this person that what I wanted to do was to, in the first, it's divided into three books, and in the first book I wanted to change it a bit and to make it more like a novel, in the sense that I wanted to try to convey the sense of incredible wonder and mystery that we lived in that period, because we were trying to awaken to this idea that we weren't properly conscious, and that these views of the sleeping world, and that everybody was asleep, and how it was really incredibly intense and provocative and thrilling and mysterious and strange and you know, just such a departure from anything. It was all unimaginable, in a sense. I would never in a billion years have ever been able to imagine that my life could change like that, because of being introduced to these ideas and starting to study myself and the world in these completely different terms. And I mean, we went through this together, and I mean, I think partly, like, if we hadn't have gone through it together, I would have thought I was, you know, I must be imagining this, but you were saying the same things, and we were sharing information all the time and observations and developing our ideas and our understanding of things. And it's so far from where anybody is in terms of modern psychological theorizing that it's otherworldly in that sense. It's really quite alien to everything that people take for granted in psychological theorizing.
What Gurdjieff would call all the rubbish accumulated through the centuries in human mentation.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Because from Gurdjieff's perspective, all modern theories about consciousness and the nature of self, in a way, it's just all rubbish. It's just all a completely false understanding, where the professionals are taking this false consciousness system to be what consciousness is. In a way, they make exactly the mistake that Gurdjieff outlines, in a way. I mean, psychologists do make those mistakes because they think we're properly conscious.
And they try to study consciousness where it doesn't exist, you know.
Yeah.
And they try to study it without studying themselves, which is impossible. It's upside down, topsy turvy, as Beelzebub would say. in the peculiar psyches of the three brain beings of the planet Earth. And that, I mean, that really is that I, when I read almost anything in from any conventional thinker about now, that for, in psychology of consciousness, now after 35 years of reading this, I there's all sorts of interesting facts and
yeah.
studies and things, but it's all wrong in my opinion. Like I just
yeah.
see it as being so off base. And then when I read a book like Susan Blackmore's book on Conversations on Consciousness, what the world's leading scientists think about consciousness, you know, complete bullshit, you know, the whole book is complete crap, you know, it's like, I mean, there's some interesting things in it, but it's all wrong, and I highly dispute the people that she, you know, nominates as being the leading thinkers on consciousness, because I think there are people out there who have radically different ideas and who should have been...
That's interesting, that's an interesting phrase, you see, say the... Like predominant thinkers on consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it is. That's what we got in science. We got thinkers on consciousness.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then
and
they end up thinking their consciousness consists in the thinking. that's funny. Thinking.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, that book doesn't, isn't it the book with like about 12 brains on the front?
No, there's just two, but. You know.
Oh, just two?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But
you know,
funny.
Another example, like, to illustrate this idea between the head doctrine and the heart doctrine, it has to do with how we experience our emotions. Because in science today, psychologists and scientists now think that our emotional centers are really up in the limbic system.
Yeah.
And, you know, involving the amygdala and the fornix body, the midbrain structures. And they think that that's kind of the emotional center because they can stimulate that part of the brain and causes animals to experience rage and other emotional states.
Yeah,
yeah, no wonder. But anyway, so psychologists today kind of think that the emotional center is up in the head. And you just imagine in a way, like, imagine going up and telling your other half that you love them with all your head. Okay, now, are you going to call your sweetheart your sweet head?
Yeah.
Are you going to give your girlfriend or boyfriend a Valentine with a picture of a brain on it? Okay. Now
I love you. I love you from the bottom of my limbic system.
Yeah. So in a way, it's like absurd. But people intuitively have deeper knowledge because people say they feel heartbroken, which I would say can happen. You can feel emptiness in the heart. You can
research that suggests that you can die of a broken heart now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in psychology it's like they put everything up in the brain and they don't think that human beings can really feel things in the heart. There's no psychology of the heart in modern science. They think there's the mind in the head, and then there's the body, and it's dualistic. They don't even get so far as differentiating thinking from feeling from sensation. They just think there's the mind and the body. They have no heart and soul. So, that was an example like how you were saying, how Gurdjieff, he explains that we don't just have one mind. You know, we have the intellectual center in the head, but we have these other minds. Like the heart is a mind of its own.
Yeah.
You know, so really we have these different centers of activity, and consciousness can exist all through the body in relationship to these different centers. And I think the more you become aware of it, the more and more it makes sense and it seems obvious. The more I consider the head doctrine over time, like I just see it as more and more absurd.
Yeah,
like
inconsistent
with all experiential data and clinical observation.
Yeah, and that's I guess there's this whole part to it in terms of mystical and esoteric teachings is that these are people who have formulated these teachings that have studied themselves and have tried to develop consciousness, and there's this striking unanimity throughout these teachings about the importance of the heart and about spiritual sparks, and it's like over and over and over again, people observe the same thing. And it's often related to these transcendent and higher states of consciousness. So it's like what these people have formulated, and the coherence and the elegance and the brilliance of what they've formulated convinces me that they know a lot more about consciousness than anybody in modern science or psychology. And that evidentiary body does not come into play in contemporary theorizers' attempts to talk about consciousness and to try to understand it. It's interesting that in that Conversations on Consciousness book, John Searle, the philosopher of consciousness, says that he has written at times some very beautiful things about the mystery of consciousness, and is very, I think, is very forthright and frank and really quite good on when he's talking about what we don't know about consciousness. But in that book, he says at one point to Susan Blackmore, he says, what we know about consciousness is that every experience, every damn one of them, originates in the neurochemical processes in the brain. I'm paraphrasing, but that the key part is, I'm quoting is, every damn one of them. So, like, on the one hand, he admits, like, we don't really know what consciousness is, but he knows that everything that you experience in your consciousness originates in your brain. That's absurd. I mean, it's completely idiotic, you know, to say that.
Yeah.
And he's a philosopher, and philosophers are trained to be very discriminating and exacting in their premises and trying not to, you know, to draw conclusions that are unsubstantiated or inconsistent with your premises. It's so peculiar how people go off on these weird tangents and things. But the bigger thing is that they've just it's like Western science has decided that nothing that ever happened before the 17th century is of any value in the human history. You know, like all previous thoughts, philosophical thoughts, and of course all mysticism and all psychological systems were all wrong because they weren't scientific. I mean, just completely ridiculous and highly arrogant. And oh, by the way, just while I think of it, this just reminded me of something. You know, at the beginning of Stephen Hawking's latest book, he says philosophy is dead, eh? He just says it. I was like, oh, well, thanks for clearing that up. You know, completely absurd, too. I was just thinking about
and
that.
And then he offers the absolutely most superficial philosophy.
Exactly.
As though he's not philosophizing. I mean, his thing is philosophizing.
That's
philosophy.
Not only philosophizing, he's philosophizing very badly, you know, and really in a quite ignorant fashion. That's such a peculiar book, his book. He says so many odd things about the nature of reality. It's like, boy, you know, I'm glad he's accomplished in his field, but I wish he'd stay in it, you know, because he's really not terribly bright when he ventures beyond physics. It's so odd that, but again, that's kind of the whole climate that's been created in the discussions of the nature of the soul and spirit and the psyche by this bizarre distortion in Western science and psychology, and even like, you know, in the study of consciousness, but just the study of the mind itself and the brain. It's odd, because for many, many years, consciousness was banned from discussion within psychology, which is an absurdity in and of itself. But under the behaviorist, like psychology, for about 40 years, academic experimental psychology didn't even allow for the existence of consciousness. You weren't allowed to talk about it. And then in the 60s, it sort of gradually began to creep into discussions, and people realized, well, you know, we have to talk about it. But it's so odd that they began to think about it and theorize about it, and what did the psychology of consciousness become equated with? It became equated with cognitive science. Like, consciousness is equal to the contents of experience, like the William James's phrase, the stream of experience, and particularly with thought and with cognitive processes. So again, this is like this essential self element being projected as being the essence of consciousness, and yet people don't seem to recognize how simplistic and how ridiculous that is, that consciousness is much more. Again, I think, therefore I am, you know, but no, you know, mystics and esoteric teachers have been saying for 5 to 10,000 years that thinking is an obstacle to the development of consciousness, and yet people don't seem to. It's so bizarre. I've used that word like 3 or 4 times, but it is bizarre how Western science is so distorted in its approach to the study of consciousness. There are so many fundamentally wrong ideas about it.
I can, from Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's Tales, it's like I see modern psychology now as another one of those Husnamussian sciences that he talks about, like where he says he wants to destroy without mercy all the rubbish accumulated through centuries in human mentation. It's like much of modern psychology is of that bent. Even though at the same time that's not true, because, I mean, I also find there's something of value in every aspect of psychology that I studied, especially if you have a broader framework of ideas. It's just that it's in certain key areas they have the completely wrong idea. Like they have the completely wrong idea about what is consciousness. Is it possible human beings have a central eye? And what is, how could that work? Does a human being have a spiritual or soul nature? So it's in those areas, like science draws a blank. Like they have no way of dealing with those issues. And that's what we get from the mystical perspective. And we can approach those issues in a scientific way. Like I don't see mystical teachings as non-scientific. I see them as a more advanced form of science, which considers the nature of the observer in the equation.
Because
in a way, we can't ignore the issue of consciousness, because in a way, it's the fundamental existent thing that allows this whole question to arise.
Yeah.
Like if there was no consciousness, so
there'd be nobody asking any questions.
Yeah, there wouldn't be. So you can't. You can't think that you can study the world while ignoring the issue of what is the nature of the consciousness that's apprehending the world. Like, it's not scientific to ignore it. That's quack science in a way. Behaviorism was a quack science. I mean, as an ultimate model of human beings. It was very valuable in its own domain, looking at the laws of conditioning and learning and so on. So it was very valuable, but as a model, of a complete model, that's where the problem is.
Yeah, it's like the old story about the blind man and the elephant. You know, modern psychology has touched all sorts of parts and has really quite detailed maps of them. But the mistake they make is that there's no relationship to the greater whole, and that's where, as you say, once you've acquired the mystical or esoteric perspective, I think it actually deepens your appreciation of what modern psychology has established. I mean, it's like modern psychology has a brain, but it has no heart and it has no spirit.
Yeah.
You know, and to a certain extent, I think it has a body too. Like, you know, as I say, I'm always struck when I was an undergraduate and then a graduate student of psychology, what struck me most about most experimental designs, like I studied personality theory and was interested in self-perception, as specifically the questions I was most interested in, was how much of it was basically, most of the studies really manipulated some sort of information processing, cognitive dimension of things, and never really, like, the any consideration of emotional variables was basically, you know, they were just held constant by ignoring them, and the same with physical variables. So what you weren't really studying people, you were studying little bits of people in these contrived situations and drawing these vastly overrated, overgeneralized conclusions based on these very contrived studies that certainly yielded some interesting information, but the mistake was in not realizing how contrived they really were. You know, like how these studies were, how contrived they really were. It's like that's another thing that from studying the fourth way, which Gurdjieff addresses directly, and which like through readings in Buddhism I had some idea about, but really had never been able to recognize, is like in Buddhism they talk about non-attachment, but in Gurdjieff's teaching he talks about identification as the fundamental wrong work of the emotional centers, that we're identified with everything, that we're invested in, and we're absorbed and embedded in emotional processes and attached to everything through emotional identification. And once you begin to realize that, like Gurdjieff says, that's the primary obstacle to remembering yourself, in other words, to becoming more conscious of yourself, is that you have no I experience. You can never develop an I experience because you have all these little different eyes of yourself that are identified with this and with that, you know, with your baseball team and with the way that you, you know, carry your nose aloft and adopt a certain air when you're with people. You know, I mean, we're identified with a billion different things, the way you are on the radio, you know. We're always identified, and it's like the emotional medium in which and through which we exist. But if we can begin to disidentify, you experience a very radically different quality to your consciousness. Even in very brief moments where you can see that you're identified, if you can stop identifying, you see, like, oh, everything could change. It's like the effect of LSD on people's consciousness. I think one of the most important aspects of that is that it makes people disidentify, is that they drop a lot of their identifications, and they realize that there's a sort of bewildering separation from your normal sense of yourself because you're not identified with what you're normally identified with.
And yeah, in breaks a way, down those habit structures of
yeah.
thinking and feeling. Yeah. I was quite impacted by my LSD experiences like 40 years ago now, during the period where we explored it while we were at university. And
yep.
And I remember I felt on the influence of LSD, I felt more myself. It was like waking up to the world, and the world was so rich and fresh and
immediate.
And I felt so alive. And I remember I realized, oh, I wanted to be able to stay in that state. And then you kind of came down and you lost that feeling, and I wanted to get back to that. And I think that's what has led to this lifetime of mystical studies, like how do we attain those states and live in the essence and experience like that, but not dependent on the drugs, but rather just dependent on the development of our own inner awareness. Because
yeah.
I think LSD does break down all that conditioning, and in, as Huxley says, it in a way it cleanses the doors of perception. So
yeah.
It takes you back to a lower level of immediacy of sensation and awareness, which in a way we've lost. In a way it takes us back to, I think, our state. You're more like children on LSD. This is assuming that you're not doing it in a crazy environment with violence and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is if people have LSD in a supportive environment and have positive experiences with it, then it really shows you something about your own psyche, about how your mind and consciousness can be so different, and you can experience things so differently.
Yeah, and again, I think it's interesting because I think that, in a way, for both you and I, even though I could never have articulated things in those terms, I think those experiences with LSD when we were undergraduates made us much more open to ideas about that consciousness could be altered, first of all, and interest in consciousness being altered. And as I say, there's a certain recognition that when we began to study ourselves and try to awaken, that, hey, there's something familiar about this. And that's what struck me, is that you know, especially studying identification, I realized, well, this is like being on acid, in a sense, is that there are these moments
yeah.
where you're not identified, where you separate from yourself, from your normal emotional investment in yourself, and you see yourself objectively, and you just are. And it's like you say, you feel more real. And I think, gee, this is kind of like, you know, it's kind of like being on drugs, only in a good sense, because you don't need the drugs, and because there's something so powerful and intense and immediate about it that you want more of it, and you realize, well, if I'm this way when I'm not identified, obviously I'm losing something very essential when I'm in my normal personality structure and identified with everything. And that's kind of the impetus in Gurdjieff's system. And on the one hand, he's painting this very bleak picture of people being asleep and being conditioned and hapless automatons buffeted about by external circumstances. You know, no single unified I, unable to do, you know, living in a sleeping world, you know, with all the horror going on around him. It's a terrible picture. But the flip side of it is that even waking up for even a few moments is such an intense experience and accumulates and changes the quality of what you realize is possible in life, that it's so inspiring that it propels you forward and wants you to do more and to learn more about yourself and to develop these capacities within yourself, because you realize, like the other side, like Gurdjieff says, is that people have no awareness of what is possible for them to realize in their lives if they were to awaken. Like everything would change. That people can't even imagine what they're capable of doing if they were awake, and that's the, as I say, that's the counter to this very bleak reality that he's describing, and that's kind of what the wonder and the inspiration was for, I think, for us in the first few years that we began to study ourselves in terms of the fourth way, is that you see, oh gee, you know, like life is like much deeper in its possibilities and much deeper in its meaning than what we've been taught and what we've been brought up.
I mean, there's no system of teaching that I'm familiar with that is as practical a system of psychology and for self-study as the fourth way teaching. Like,
no,
it is just so practical. The language, the distinction between the centers is just so immensely valuable. I remember, like, one of the things emphasized in the fourth way is struggling against negative emotions, that ideally we would be without negative emotions, meaning anger, resentment, depression, worry, fearfulness, all kinds of negative emotions. And so we have that idea of struggling with negative emotions because, in a way, people have so many negative emotions all the time, they're continually squandering their emotional energies. So Gurdjieff compares it like filling a sieve. You know, a person, the body's producing these emotional energies, but we're wasting them all the time on all our attachments to things, especially to negative emotions. And negative emotions, you begin to study yourself and other people, you see how many of them you have all the time about all kinds of things, and you see it in other people. And as you start learning to let those go at different points in your day, you can start to have a negative emotion, but become aware of it. And as you become aware of it, and you become aware of the circumstance and what that is in you, in a way you can dissipate it and not have that reaction. And that those moments, they're amazing, because it, like, all that energy that would otherwise have been wasted, you kind of retain it, and you just let go of that reaction, and you realize, I am not that. You begin to kind of separate the I from the it, and you start seeing your negative emotions are more like the its, you know?
Yeah.
And they are not I. And there is something so liberating in that, and then learning to be freer and freer of negative emotions. And all of that, in as Gurdjieff explains, accumulates these emotional energies which go to refining the energies or hydrogens needed for the astral body. So I think early on in our kind of self-study, we both had those experiences of, like, I would be about to say something, and I would become conscious of what I was about to say before I said it, and I would not say it. I would just let it go, because in a way I could see where what I was going to say was from my own ego or my own, and I just let it go. It was like learning to be nothing in a way that something to learning to be nothing, meaning not being attached and identified with all these things. And there's something really liberating in that. And the more you do that, it's the more unencumbered you are and the more your awareness is enhanced. A person can get very immediate benefits from self-remembering and struggling with negative emotions, and observing different eyes is a fascinating subject. And seeing how you don't have will, how, like, if a person sets themselves the intention to self-remember, I would see it in my classes all the time at university at York. I'd have a class of 150 people, and everybody, I'd try to explain what self-remembering was, and people would have to do it between one class and the next class to remember to do it. And then you come back the next class, and I'd talked about it for half an hour, and, like, hardly anyone in the class remembered to do it.
Yeah.
Because as soon as the class was over, everybody, you know, hey, Joe, you know, you want to go to the pub and you do this and you do that, and then you go take the bus and you get caught up everything in your life and you completely forget about self-remembering. And then there you are the next day and the teacher asks, did you remember yourself? And you, oh, I completely forgot. You see? And that's kind of like the whole point of it is when you begin to try to self-remember, you very soon realize how you can't do it and why you can't do it. The reason you can't do it is because you have no central eye. It's just one little eye that has the idea of self-remembering, but that's not a permanent eye. A moment from now, it'll be, you know, you see a nice blonde and you forget your intent to self-remembering. You know, you're lost all the time. And that's what you begin to see when you start making the effort to self-remember and to enhance your awareness. And you begin, it's a fascinating process, and it makes life like not a mystery or thrilling in a way. It's like you can be anywhere doing anything, and you can kind of, there's this whole other dimension you can be in.
Yeah,
it's a fascinating process.
I think somebody says something to the effect that, commenting on the fourth way, I think it might be Maurice Nichols said something to the effect that at the beginning you realize that you can't change yourself, but you can change the meaning of things for yourself. And that's what I think, you know, we found is like the meaning of everything changed with these ideas and trying to implement them in our lives. And that's, to me, like, that's what I found in this stood apart from the fourth way from every other philosophy or system that I'd ever studied of ideas is that it was so utterly immensely practical, you know, I could apply this all the time and it changed everything, you know, and it was just so there was no question about it. It was just so you know, obvious that these things were correct and to me that I didn't spend time debating whether or not, you know, well, what's the meaning of this? The meaning of it became very clear to me. Like you say, you try to self-remember and then you realize like hours go by or days and then you realize, oh yeah, I was going to try to self-remember and I forgot, you know, and you realize you can't do it. But when you can do it, when you can remember to remember, it changes everything, even briefly. Could I just read the beginning of this thing from Donna Brown?
Oh yeah, okay.
Would you like to do a little bit because we've got about a half an hour to go.
We want to get by that because then over the next weeks we're gonna we'll go through psychological illusions and then work with Beelzebub's tale. So it would be, why don't we go through the review and we'll take the last half hour to go through that.
I think our discussion so far sort of set up a little bit better, background to understand what she's saying in parts of her review, because she begins by saying the field of consciousness exploration, the last great mystery, quote unquote, is one of the fastest growing fields of scientific inquiry. Theories examining the roots, nature, and role of human consciousness abound. At present, there are at least 12 competing theories. Many modern scientific theories rely on the materialist argument that depicts consciousness and mind as an emergent phenomenon or emergent property of the brain. Yet, as Dr. Christopher Holmes points out again and again in this book, no definitive scientific theory on the origin and nature of human consciousness exists, and any real understanding of consciousness remains elusive. Science rejects the idea of any supernatural or non-physical explanation, but provides, quote, no account of what consciousness is, whether or not it is substantive, or where it originates, unquote, and that's from you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Despite the widespread confusion and misunderstanding regarding the nature of consciousness and the narrow form-based, technologically-driven investigation into the material, neurological, and informational processes of the brain, the head doctrine, as Helena Blavatsky once termed it, has become, quote, the most commonly accepted Western scientific and psychological model of consciousness, unquote. Again, that's from you.
Yeah, Jim, actually, I don't think Helena Blavatsky used the phrase the head doctrine.
I know, I was going to say, I don't think she did either.
She actually used the phrase heart doctrine.
Yeah.
But what I did in my presentation of these books, I called it the head doctrine in order just to contrast it with the heart doctrine.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know she used the heart doctrine, but I don't think she, I was going to say, did she actually ever use the head? That's you,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no, she hadn't.
Holmes examines the modern head doctrine of psychology, philosophy, and science. He acknowledges the contributions that modern science has made, particularly in its understanding of the anatomy and physiology of the brain. However, he challenges its assumptive and speculative framework, along with the biases of researchers and theorists who, quote, see no way for consciousness to emerge or be generated apart from a functioning brain, unquote. Holmes addresses the multiple questions concerning consciousness in psychology, physics, cosmology, biology, and medicine that science has either ignored or left unanswered. His critique reveals a science that generalizes its knowledge of the part as if it were a knowledge of the whole. Oh, that's really good, eh?
Yeah, that is nice. Yeah.
A science that is ill-informed about other dimensions of reality and cut off from its inner core. Wow. Well, would you care to comment on...
Well, that's exactly right.
No way for consciousness to emerge or be generated apart from a functioning brain. I mean, I think that's really critical, eh? Like,
yeah, that's a quote from Roger Sperry. Who says that, very famous neurosurgeon.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says he saw no way for consciousness to emerge or be generated apart from a functioning brain. But what I point out in my book, he doesn't see any way for it to be generated by a functioning brain. Like he's saying, I don't see how it can be generated apart from the brain, but he also can't explain how it's generated by the brain.
Like, yeah, which is just like Searle saying, oh, we don't really know what consciousness is. We just know that all your experiences that are conscious are generated by your brain, every damn one of them. I was like, what? You know, it's so illogical. Like,
It's so illogical even on scientific basis because even if you take the human being and you think consciousness is produced by neurological activity, okay, well, then you got all kinds of neurological activity extending all through your body.
Yeah.
The solar plexus is a huge neurological complex.
There are more neurons in your guts than there are in your brains.
Yeah, they're huge, and the heart has its own electromagnetic system. So these scientists who even do think that consciousness is produced by neurological activity, well, still that doesn't justify localizing it only in the brain. It doesn't make sense because you could be experiencing the electromagnetic activity of your solar plexus. Which is what it seems to us. See, your solar plexus isn't represented up in your cerebral cortex. No, we experience feelings directly there.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's not represented up in the sensory motor strip. You see,
it's
part of the autonomic nervous system. So that shows, here a person's experiencing activity in the solar plexus. And you could map it. You could verify that in the data in a lab easily. That the person can experience inwardly this activity going on in their solar plexus. Okay, so it shows that consciousness can exist in all neurological activity isn't up in the brain. The whole body is electromagnetic in nature.
And again, as you pointed out many times in this program, I mean, it's blood flow is so central, so that people observing activities in the brain, they inject dyes and they watch where blood flows. But the same thing can be said about consciousness in the body. Like the example you used earlier, you know, you can increase your blood flow to your feet and become more conscious to your feet. When you're sexually excited, you're not in your brain, you're centered in your sexual organs because there's an increase of flow to your sex organs. When you know
what you could do as an experiment? I just thought of this. You could inject a dye into someone and then get them to eat a heavy meal, and you'd see all the dye go to their stomach.
Yeah, exactly.
So there you'd say, the stomach is creating consciousness.
Yeah,
right? I mean, if you followed their logic.
Exactly. And, or, you know, what happens, I mean, everybody's done this experiment, like, involuntarily. You lie on your arm when you're asleep, or, you know, you sit in an awkward position, and you lose all the feeling because you've cut the blood flow off. So you don't have consciousness of a body part because you've cut the flow of blood off.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, so it's, consciousness clearly is, you know, integrally related to the idea to the existence of blood flow, and that, you know, and your blood is carrying everything throughout your body. Like, I mean, you know, that's
the oxygen, which is the basis of all metabolism and the nutrients,
and neural hormones, which circulate in the bloodstream throughout the entire body. I mean, you know, everything. So anyway, back to the I just thought you might want to comment on that Sperry comic, because I, you know. Okay, so with over 35 years of study in the area of consciousness, psychology, modern physics, and metaphysics to draw upon, Dr. Holmes provides an alternative higher-dimensional model of consciousness that is in sharp contrast to the reductionist paradigm. At the center of his research is the enigmatic concept of the zero point, a term used by Helena Blavatsky and recently documented in physics to represent, quote, a point source of unfolding wherein the finite cosmos emerged from the infinite at the beginning of time, unquote. These zero points, or true atoms, which the gods and other invisible powers use to clothe themselves, occur at, quote, the level of the Planckian unit in physics beyond the level of material differentiation, but existent in all living beings, including ourselves.
Yeah, it's a difficult section.
Yeah.
It's talking, at one point it's more talking about the idea of how our cosmos or universe emerged from a first point, a singularity point. And then it's going on, as she says, like what I'm saying is that I'm saying that all living beings have such zero point centers, like a first point of differentiation.
Right.
These points are called zero points because they're so small, they're beyond the level of our physical differentiation. But there could be many levels of different zero points. Like you could narrow one world to a zero point, and you might kind of go through a portal that opened into another dimension, and you might come back. There might be other levels of zero point passages through dimensions. Like, I think zero point structures could be hierarchical.
Yeah.
Like there's an original zero point of the universe, but then every living being has a zero-point center in the heart. But all the living beings with zero-point centers in their heart, those zero-point centers are all related to the zero-point origin of the universe. So there's this kind of hierarchical zero-point inner structures. But anyway, and she quotes that very important quote from Blavatsky, who says, like, zero points are the means by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies.
Yeah.
So it's like we have this kind of first point, and then that point is closed. So there's different bodies formed around the central point.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you want to pick up?
So the author elaborates and expands upon Blavatsky's initial concept in this important work and throughout the entire Within Without Zero Point series, which refers to your series of books. In The Heart Doctrine, the first book in the series, we learn that the zero point is not a thing in itself as much as it is a condition or a place at which certain processes occur. Sorry, that I should have said that was a quote from you, that beginning with the zero point. So the zero point is not a thing in itself as much as it is a condition or a place at which certain processes occur. This zero point is a point particle, a monad in hyperspace, or a portal or transitional point between dimensions. According to Holmes, zero points are present throughout creation. They exist, quote, at the heart of the universe, a galaxy, the heart of a universe, a galaxy, a sun, a quantum, or a human being, unquote. Thus, he concludes, quote, life within a living being originates within, without, out of the higher space dimensions of a multidimensional heart.
Wow, what a nice line.
Yeah, unquote. That's you. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. Holmes furthers this hypothesis by explaining how the essential point source of individual light consciousness, the God spark or quantum self, is brought down to the various planes where it is embodied as a soul and as the electromagnetic center within the physical heart. He describes a process whereby the presence of the self within the heart initiates the heartbeat and diffuses the light of consciousness, which the mind reflects to both the psyche and the body. Consciousness, as the zero-point theory maintains, quote, does not arise from within the brain. The brain merely mirrors the light from within the spiritual heart and space, unquote.
Beautiful. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. The zero-point hypothesis serves as a lens or vehicle through which the author considers a wide range of literature from the sacred wisdom teachings and contemplative traditions. These sacred teachings, which have developed their own rigorous methods for exploring the origins and potential of consciousness, emphasize the heart doctrine and the view that the heart and physical consciousness are inextricably related. A verse from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad illustrates, quote, the self-luminous being who dwells within the lotus of the heart, surrounded by the senses and sense organs, and who is the light of the intellect, is that self. So the self-luminous being who dwells within the lotus of the heart, surrounded by the senses and sense organs, and who is the light of the intellect, is that self. Another verse from that.
Yeah, that's so important.
That's
the essence of heart doctrine, and that's why the mystics compare the self within the heart to the sun, which is inherently self-illuminating.
Self-illuminating, yeah.
And the mind in the head is compared to the moon, because the moon doesn't have its own light; it only reflects the light of the sun. And similarly, the mind in the head, you have consciousness in the mind in the head. Because what the blood flow from the heart into the mind, and the light of the self in the heart is spread through the blood and the subtle anatomy, and it illuminates the mind in the head. So there are different orbits of consciousness, awareness related to the mind.
It's such an important idea too, because it the more you examine and explore the holographic paradigm, the more you realize how, like, totally coherent and consistent with the holographic paradigm this idea is. It's like that there's this higher dimensional light which is stepped down, which is the origin within the self, within the heart, is the origin of the consciousness and the life principle within the body. And this idea that the head brain doesn't have its own light but reflects the light as the relationship of the moon to the sun is so important. Like I think that's just so critical. It's like,
illustrates the alternative perspective.
You could read that. You could read the Upanishads, and I would have probably read that before your work, and said, "Well, that's nice poetry, but this isn't poetry, and it's not a metaphor. They mean this literally. Like this is an analogy which is meant to describe a scientific reality, like a reality of the nature of the heart and its relationship to the brain, and how the consciousness and life arises within an individual."
That's a really good point you're making, Jim, because in a way that's what I think we've done a bit, is that we've taken, like, taken what has been said by, like, Krishna in the Gita or the Upanishads, and we've considered those, what they're saying in what seems to be poetry or something. We've looked at it, like, from a scientific perspective and saying, well, what would this mean? How could this be true? So it's allowed us to kind of interpret these kinds of verses in a new way in light of modern knowledge and understanding.
Yeah, and again, I've said this before on the program, but I'll say it again. It's interesting that even people who are sympathetic to or who have studied mystical and esoteric teachings, I'm specifically thinking of Ken Wilber, and you know, my apologies to Wilber if I'm misrepresenting him, but I don't think I am because I've read a fair amount of his work. I don't think he sees the heart doctrine, you know, because at times he says things that are so consistent with the head doctrine. He's very sophisticated in his theorizing and his commentary about consciousness, and he clearly, you know, has studied widely in all of these esoteric and mystical traditions, but I don't think he recognizes it, you know. I think he subscribes to the head doctrine. So it's interesting, eh? Like, I mean, this is very, very different to take this as no, this isn't poetry. This is the real thing, you know. So it requires such a, you know, it's like those tests that people send you in emails, you know, where you have a built-in habitual association to something, and you have to step outside your usual framework, you know, into those mind twisters. That's kind of what the situation is in Western science with regard to consciousness. Everybody's so rooted in these conventional assumptions and semi-established truths that nobody can kind of even see what's staring them in the face. I mean, it's so shocking when you begin to read the heart doctrine, when you read in your book how consistently and repeatedly this teaching occurs about the heart doctrine, but nobody seems to recognize. It's staring you in the face once you see it. You know, as I told you, at one point I had to tell you, you know, I think you got too many quotes, like, because you had so many sources where this was said. It was like overkill, you know, and it was just astonishing to me. And I mean, I'd read some of this material, but I'd never recognized it, you know. And as I say, I don't think a lot of people who are even sympathetic to these ideas recognize. But once you see it, it's like, how come nobody sees it, you know?
Yeah, it's like having a key to the esoteric literature.
Yes.
I think
there
are certain keys. Like, I think the idea of the heart doctrine is an essential key to understanding spiritual literature. I think the understanding of the laws of 3 and 7 are keys to understanding the mystical literature. Yeah.
The idea of
we should probably move along because we have just over 5 minutes left. So why don't you pick it up? There was another Upanishad that.
Yeah, and this is my favorite. This is one of my favorite quotes, and I told Donna in an email that I'm glad she included this in a review because I love this quote. Another verse from the Chandogya Upanishad is placed within the context of the heart's innate ability to reflect the holographic dimensions of the universe. Quote, as large as the universe outside, even so large is the universe within the lotus of the heart. Within it are heaven and earth, the sun, the moon, the lightning, and all the stars. What is in the macrocosm is in the microcosm. All things that exist are in the city of Brahman. Like, I mean, that's the holographic paradigm in a nutshell.
Absolutely. The part embodies the whole. Within the deepest physics or higher dimensional physics of the heart somehow embodies or is interrelated to the whole of the universe. The sources of Brahman, like the creator.
Yeah, and if you really read that, like the theory of non-locality is there. You know, it's a statement that the locality is an illusion, that we live in a non-local, on some essential higher dimensional level, we live in a non-local universe, and it's intimately related to the self within the heart. It's an astounding statement. Like, I mean, it's just amazing when you understand what's being said. Elsewhere, the author draws upon the teachings of Jesus Christ, St. Francis de Sales, Father Louis Massignol, Father Merton, and others to reveal that both the heart doctrine and the zero-point teaching teachings are inherent to Christianity. We learn, for example, that many Christian thinkers and mystics view the parable of the mustard seed as a metaphor for the zero point, the virgin point or central point of the soul. Christian literature also, quote, depicts the heart as the bridal chamber wherein the soul is healed and wedded to the Lord, unquote. The heart, as one Christian mystic explains, refers to the, quote, interior star, quote, the one pearl, or, quote, the single eye. These many names represent the different attributes of the central point of the soul within the cave of the heart from which the self or I derives. Holmes's insightful commentaries and inspired treatment of the mystical and esoteric literature found in the Hindu, Buddhist, Islamic, Jewish, Christian, and Theosophical traditions leads the reader into the enduring universal currents of truth and beauty regarding life, the heart, consciousness, and the cosmos. His integrated overview of sacred teachings serves to illuminate their inner nexus and expose their deeper significances. Furthermore, the author demonstrates the value of esoteric and occult teachings in a profoundly new relationship to science. Spiritual teachings, as the Heart Doctrine states, quote, do not necessarily contradict the findings of science. They simply provide a new holistic way of interpreting the facts of science itself, unquote. In comparing the unifying teachings of the heart and consciousness with the ground state or zero point of quantum physics, Christopher Holmes makes a central contribution to consciousness research, a contribution with practical applications for awakening the soul or the self. And that's from Donna Brown in the Esoteric Quarterly, Fall 2010. Very good review.
Excellent outstanding review.
Yeah. Because she's captured... some of the essential points and central tenets of your model of consciousness. At the same time, she's grasped the grander implications of it vis-a-vis consciousness research today and its implications for the study of science and integration and a new synthesis of spirituality and science. It's quite a brilliant review.
Yeah, it's excellent. So, thank you, Donna. And I just send Donna psychological illusions for ladies.
Exactly.
Start light reading.
Do you have any books that are light?
Well, The Slugs is nice in that it's only 150 pages.
Yeah, it's smaller, but it makes up in weight.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Yeah.
I have done recent work on my website. My website's at www.zeropoint.ca, and there's selections of all my books up there and a lot of interesting articles. I reread my review on critique of Hawking's book, and I was very pleased with that. I think that's really interesting. And I put up some new writings on the Hasnamath sciences, and revised my sections on Gurdjieff's views of the causes of war. I put new chapters up on my website, so I hope people may have a look at my website. Also put pictures of chemtrails in Kempville, how we're being sprayed here, being poisoned here with the chemtrails.
Oh, that's nice.
So anyway, thanks, Jim. We'll be back. 2 weeks, and next time we'll pick up and we'll go through some of the psychological illusions, and maybe the week after that we'll begin Beelzebub's Tales. I'm going to try to read through the book again I'd like to do some readings of it. It would be really, it's so funny.
Yeah.
It's just so funny.
Yeah, I would too. I'll try to get through it before a couple of weeks, and I began to look at psychological illusions too, so... Okay.
Yeah,
that was really good because I really enjoyed it. It was a very interesting talk and wide ranging.
Yeah. We usually do. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, BBS Radio, and we'll be back in 2 weeks. So I encourage people, try to remember yourself. Try to remember to hear some of what we're talking about and see if in 2 weeks when I say, "Did you remember yourself?" Okay, goodbye. Thank you.
No, something happened.
Yes, something happened.
Bye, Chris. See ya.
Bye.